السلام عليكم. Lo and behold, while sojourning in Egypt, in a small town on the banks of the Nile, I fell passionately in love with a young girl. For many days I remained practically without food and without drink, and in this way the flame of love within me became extraordinarily intense. My breath exhaled flames of fire, and each time I breathed out fire, lo and behold, from the height of heaven, someone was also breathing out fire, which came to meet my own breath. The two shafts of flame blended between the heavens and me. For a long time, I did not know who was here, who was there, at the place where the two flames came together. But at last, I understood that it was my witness in heaven. When Subhuti suggested that I do something to explore the Gestalt, the myth, I immediately thought of this passage. So, there you are. It was written by a great 13th century Central Asian Sufi named Nakhmuddin Kobra. And it's quoted in the first book I ever read on Sufism in around 1984, entitled The Man of Light in Iranian Sufism by Henri Corbin, great French explorer of Sufism and other themes. And I had come to read this book because of Banti. At various times in the 1980s, on seminars, Banti would refer to Sufism, even going so far as to say that the records of the spiritual experiences of some Sufis came close to describing something transcendental. I can't recall Banti mentioning the Man of Light in Iranian Sufism, but it was one of the books in his library. There was the, in the Padmaloka, there was the Order Library, and then there was another library which I think was sort of part of the Order Library, but it was things that Banti had bought. And The Man of Light in Iranian Sufism was one of the books in there, along with other books on Sufism, which I had a good look at. Later on, I should just say, one of Surya Prabha's really great films about the early days of the movement, there's a wonderful moment where Banti is talking about a retreat he did on a Cornish clifftop, in a chalet on a Cornish clifftop. And he was saying, rather cryptically on the film, that during that retreat, he had a direct insight into the Sufi experience. He just knew what the Sufi experience was. Later on, I asked him what that experience was, and he said, I'm sorry, I can't really tell you. But he said, I can tell you what I was reading at the time. I was reading the Grail literature. I was reading all about the Holy Grail, which is interesting because there's a strong relationship between, well, they talk sometimes about Sufi chivalry, fatwa, they call it. It's a very strong theme in Sufi practice. In Surya Prabha's film, by the way, there's a brilliant cut at the moment where Banti talks about his direct experience of Sufism, a brilliant cut. Surya Prabha goes straight to a painting of a beautiful Persian miniature of an angel, you know, and these Persian angels are Turkoman youths, beardless youths with wonderful glossy black hair and wonderful long eyes and gorgeous robes. And the music at that moment was, of course, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan doing his qawwali. It's an incredibly exhilarating moment in that film. So thank you very much, Surya Prabha. Now, the Man of Light in Iranian Sufism, especially a quote like that, there are a few others in the book, but that one in particular sparked off an intense love in me for aspects of Sufi tradition, an intense fascination, and it continues to the present day. It's still alive for me it's not a phase. I thought it was a phase. It's not a phase. And this has affected me in many, many ways. In India, for example, when I go to India, I started to go to, sometimes my Buddhist friends are a little bit alarmed by this, but I'd go to the dargahs, the shrines of some of the Sufi saints. Usually the more obscure in some ways and the more out of the way are the more interesting. Or not just interesting, you can feel what they call the baraka. And I've had quite deep meditations in some Sufi tombs. Again, Bhante is partly responsible for this because he talks in one of his travel letters about going to a famous Sufi dargah in near Ahmedabad in Gujarat and talking about the remarkable atmosphere of the shrine. My interest, passion for Sufism has affected my dream life very strongly. In the early days of the Preceptors' College, when there were just a few of us in the college, I had a dream where all of us public preceptors, Sabuti, Sri Mala, myself, Sangha Devi, and so on, Sona, Suvadra, we were all at a Sufi dargah, and we were all in blue, you know, light blue. Blue, by the way, is a Sufi colour. There are blue Sufis. And we were all at this dargah, this shrine. And Bhante came along, wearing his jacket and slacks and looking very much the English gentleman. And he was grinning and playful in that very arched way that he has. And relaxed, eyebrow, you know, going up a little bit. And he said, "Oh, you've become Sufis now." And I immediately bowed at his feet and touched his feet and said, "Oh, Bhante, only you are our Khwaja." Khwaja meaning a wise man, a teacher, a peer, a sheikh. Bhante is my Sufi teacher, actually. Indeed, years later, Bhante arrived at Padmaloka to stay with us for a while. And as soon as he got out of the car, it was very unusual. I've never had this sort of encounter with Bhante before. As soon as he got out of the car, he said, "I need to tell you about a dream I've had. I need to tell you about a dream I've had. So I got him into the lounge and we sat down and he said, "This is the dream I had." He said, "In this dream there was Rumi," which he said, Rumi is an intoxicated Sufi, because you get intoxicated, ecstatic Sufis and you get sober Sufis. So there's Rumi, the intoxicated Sufi, and there's another Sufi, I think it might have been Sanai, a sober Sufi. And they're standing opposite to each other in Bhante's dream, holding a piece of red cloth, holding it tightly between them. And Bhante said, then a voice came in the dream, "Rumi and Sanai, keep the Sufi path taut." And then he looked at me. So how is it that a Buddhist, a Dharmachari, an order member, one who goes for refuge to the Buddha, a disciple of Sangharakshita, a public preceptor indeed. Oh, I forgot that. How can such a one as this, so, you know, be so heterodox, can have such a strong, even intense response to Sufism, seemingly with the encouragement of his teacher? I mean, Bhante has teased me a few times about this. I mean, I was about to give a talk once, and I think you might have been there, and Bhante said, "I suppose you're going to say something about Sufism." I said, "Well, there might be a poem or two." And he said, I said, "But I'm going to read one of your poems." He said, don't try to butter me up. Or that won't save you, or something like that. I've never, by the way, doubted that the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are my refuge. I've never doubted that Bhante is my teacher and that the order is my spiritual community. I practice the precepts, I follow the system of practice. I don't doubt Pratitya Samuppada. I've never felt like leaving the order to join a Sufi order or anything like that. But I've no doubt at all that Sufism has had and continues to have a powerful effect on my life in meditation, outside of meditation. It affects the way I think and the way I feel about the Dharma. And in a way, I'm not sure I can really communicate why I'm so affected by Sufism. Years ago, I wrote an article called A Glimpse Inside of the Tavern of Rumi, which I eventually, for one reason or other, sent to a Sufi magazine, and they were very pleased to take it. I'd just sent it to a Sufi from a respectable Sufi order for some comments about whether I'd got it right, because it was kind of a lot of commentary on a Sufi poem. And he said it was very, very good. And he said, but they wanted more Buddhism in the article. I didn't actually want any Buddhism in the article. I wanted to write it as a Sufi, but he wanted more Buddhism in the article. And he did say, you seem to have really synthesized Buddhism and Sufism in your experience. I don't think that's true, actually. And by the way, I don't think others need to get into Sufism. I don't think that's necessary. It's not something I'd ever want to teach. We don't do Sufi retreats at Padmaloka. It's not an essential part of the ordination process, the men's ordination process. I don't mind if people... I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it for me. That's the interest. What you're getting is, you know, the abundance of my interest. Perhaps so there's something found in that passage of Nam Kubras that was quoted in The Man of Light. Just say something about it. Just try to get into why it's so important for me. I have to say, when I first read it, and it still happens, it's not just words on a page for me. I see it. I see it. It's vivid to me. The Sufi, the Central Asian Sufi, on probably some pilgrimage. Sufis were great travellers very often. In a small town in Egypt, on the banks of the Nile, immediately we're in a different locale, a different environment with all, I don't mind admitting, the exoticism, the strangeness of it. Egypt, a small town on the banks of the Nile. It's unfamiliar, it's strange. I think part of the thing that goes on for me with something like Sufism is that because I'm not familiar with the language, and it's a highly poetic and elusive language very often. That's very important to me, because I think, unfortunately, because I've got a very retentive memory when it comes to the Dharma, I could give you a really good exposition of Buddhist doctrine. I think it would be really orthodox, but in a way it's so great to be playing away from home, to be off balance, to be in a world that I don't understand and yet which is really calling to me. And our Sufi falls passionately in love with a young girl, a young woman. There's no description of the young girl, so the imagination can work. A beautiful young girl. And passionately in love. Passionately in love. That's very important. I suppose it has to be said, I would immediately fasten on that, because in my own life over the years, there is a susceptibility to falling passionately in love. To suddenly finding someone utterly, stunningly, breathtakingly beautiful. And this may surprise some of my friends, to the point of actually going off my food and drink. I've actually done that. Extraordinary. I mean, that really is an encounter with beauty if it puts me off my food and drink. I imagine, I'm sure I'm not alone in this phenomena of falling in love in this kind of way. And over the years in the Sangha, it's been the topic of much discussion with Bhante and with others. And the topic of falling in love has been approached from all kinds of points of view. Falling passionately in love is a kind of problem, isn't it? Because it could take you away from the Dharma life. I mean, it can. It's a problem because I suppose because it's so wonderful, falling in love, and so terrible at the same time. So wonderful because of the sudden enchantment of everything. So terrible because of that overwhelming, aching longing, that darg, as they call it in Urdu, that pain. I will leave aside all the other complexities that can arise. We won't go there. But here in this passage, passionate love for a beautiful young woman inspires, transforms. It enters into Najmuddin Kobra's spiritual quest. This reminds me, actually, saying this of another Sufi teaching of Banti. He once spoke warmly, I thought, of a Sufi master, I don't know who it was, I haven't been able to track him down, who would engineer situations in which his disciples would fall in love with someone. He'd kind of set things up, he'd have his eye out, he'd want his disciples to fall in love, he'd want that flame of love to arise. So he'd set things up so that they'd meet someone where it would happen. But as soon as he saw them fall, he ordered the disciple into retreat. And of course, this being, a proper tradition, where you obey your sheikh, your peer, your teacher. You don't say, well, I have to think about it. You go. And a Sufi retreat is 40 days of Ramadan. You don't eat or drink until the evening. And it's a time of continuous prayer and zikir, which is like our mantra recitation, and meditation. So Banti was saying, well, if you're in love and then you're in retreat immediately, with absolutely no contact with the beloved, the love, the passionate love becomes more and more intense. It actually becomes stronger and purer. The beloved is experienced vividly in the imagination as a showing of reality. Years later, I mentioned this again to Banti in a dinner conversation, I think, and Banti said, oh, did I say that? Oh, that sounds rather difficult. I love the way he does that. You have this enthusiasm and then... With our Nyam Kobra story, he remains without food and without drink for many days. There's a complete turning inwards, it seems. And we can be sure, as I've indicated, his time would have been taken up with prayer and zikir and meditation and contemplation. All of this fanning the flames of his passionate love until his breath exhaled flames of fire. And when I first read this, I sort of saw a kind of column of flame shooting upwards towards the heavens. And then he becomes aware of a response. From the height of heaven, someone was breathing flame to meet his flame. There's a response. And this had for me an immediate attraction, and still does. I'm still fascinated by this image of a flame going up with the breath and a response from on high, a flame moving to meet that breath going up. Perhaps, I don't know, it's something to do with my earliest, so to speak, spiritual experiences, spontaneous experiences, not of insight, not of vision. I don't think I could describe it like that, but more like a kind of yearning, wordless prayer, just pouring forth from the centre of the heart and feeling, sensing a response from something descending from on high. Call it a blessing, call it grace. Because it happened in a Catholic chapel for various reasons, I thought that this must indicate I was encountering God, and that must mean I must convert to Catholicism. Fortunately, when I talked to I was brought up Anglican, but I went to a Catholic school. And the headmaster got rather frightened when I talked about converting to Catholicism. Unfortunately, I didn't. But that sense of, yes, that wordless, yearning prayer going upwards, and there's a response. And perhaps that's why, for me, some of the deepest moments in meditation and contemplation, I would say, are more akin to prayer and blessing. It's more that language that I would use. That's why I find it so attractive in those sadhanas where you, those meditations where, you know, first of all, you send forth lights from yourself up into the heavens, and then there's a response from the heavens. And there's more in Najmuddin Kobra's passage. The ascending flames of passionate love. The descending flames of passionate love, because the descending flames are also passionate love. They meet. And where they meet, someone is there at that place. It's as if a sort of being forms at that place. At the place of the meeting between the two flames, between heaven and earth, a being, a person, a form, an image? I don't know. And for a long time, Najmuddin Kobra does not know who this is, this mysterious being. But at last, somehow, he understands that this being born of the meeting place of the two breaths of flame is his witness in heaven, his heavenly witness. This is a big theme in Henry Corbin's book, actually, and in The Man of Light. He explains that this is, you could describe the heavenly witness as like a heavenly twin or a suprasensory spiritual guide or the angel. But in a way, I'd prefer to stay with that mystery, the fact that, you know, in a sense that being is a mystery, the witness in heaven. That mystery, that mysterious guide, that witness in heaven, is discovered through an encounter with beauty, through passionate love, through longing and yearning, through prayer and meditation. Through the intensification of that passionate love, aroused by human beauty, certainly, but intensified and directed to the source of all beauty. And I like it, I love it, that Nam Kobra does not really describe or ascribe a personal name to his witness in heaven. It's so easy to think we really know the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or indeed our chosen deity, because we know the names, because we've read the books about the symbolism. We think we know them. There's that lovely poem by Bhante, The Guardian War, where he sees all the bodhisattvas in the heavens, and he says something like, "But the loveliest bodhisattvas are the anonymous." I've meditated upon my chosen, my witness in heaven, daily now for the best part of 38 years. And actually, I know less and less about what I'm meditating upon. The other day, I was talking to some younger order members, and they were asking me what qualities you develop through meditating, and they knew the particular practice that I meditate on. And they were asking me what qualities that I've developed through that practice, and I had to reply, I can't tell you. I don't know. I don't know what qualities develop through doing that practice. And all the things said about what this form symbolizes don't really say what he is. All I can say is that I love this form. And the best moments are when the intensity of the encounter leads to an unknowing, a kind of ecstatic unknowing. The best moments are when the beloved is strange to me. Sadhana then is not a means to get something, to even develop anything. It's more a matter of adoring and serving. I mentioned unknowing just then. Another attraction to Sufi texts is how the intensity of passionate love leads to the undoing of all knowing. There's another wonderful passage from The Man of Light in Sufism, a quotation from a Sufi master from who lived around the Caspian Sea, named Muhammad Lahiji, who wrote a very important commentary on a very famous Sufi text called the Rose Garden of Mystery. And he describes an experience of a consuming longing and nostalgia, as it were, for these coloured lands that were opening up in his meditation, all these beautiful coloured plains that he was moving towards. And then suddenly it's all consumed by a black light. A black light. There's a complete dissolution into the sun at midnight, the darkness at noonday, and there's the realization that he has nothing with which to be. In our terms, he realizes Aishvarya, as Bhante's called it, no lordship. There's no agency. Perhaps it's like a sort of spiritual death. Or another favorite Sufi, Ahmad Ghazali, who wrote the first Persian treatise on love. He says in one place, love is a man-eater because it consumes all human nature and leaves nothing behind. Nothing behind. There is just love, but without beloved, lover and love. And he talks about love being not directed to any side. It has no qibla, no direction. There's this disillusion. So love then and beauty is dangerous, as we know. Love and beauty is dangerous in the spiritual life. Surrendering to love leads to spiritual death. We lovingly work and practice and purify for the beloved. But what then? What then? Well, I'm going to end with a great Sufi poem by my master, my Khwaja, written when he was a young man. Again, a poem that haunts me still. I listened all day for the knock of the stranger, and I often looked out from the door. The table was scrubbed, the brass shining, and well swept the floor. The shadows grew longer and longer. In the grate the fire flickered and died. It's too late. He never will come now, I said, and sighed. I sat there musing and musing, the spinning wheel still at my side. The moonlight came in through the window, white like a bride. As the clock struck 12, I heard nothing, but felt he had come and stayed, waiting outside. And I listened, and I was afraid.